It's the afternoon of March 16, 1872, on a soccer field in London, England. 24-year-old Morton Betts sprints down the line, kicking up mud behind him. The crowd urges him forward. But instead, Morton cuts inside, trying to shake a trailing defender and create some space. Ahead, his teammate Walpole Gadol glides past two defenders. Walpole is known as the Prince of Dribblers, and the brown leather ball seems glued to his feet as he runs. It's 15 minutes into the final match of a new tournament, the Football Association Cup. Morton and Walpole's team, the Wanderers, are going up against the Royal Engineers, and the 2,000 people surrounding the field cheer boisterously. Because of the expensive one-shilling entry, only a privileged crowd has turned out, and Morton recognizes many of them as old schoolmates from Harrow. But he can't stop to say hello. Instead, Morton backs up Walpole as he closes in on goal. But in a last-ditch effort, a defender slides through, sending Walpole crashing into the mud, and the ball skittering loose across the wet grass. It bobbles toward Morton, who stops it with a tanned leather cleat. He glances up. The angle is tight, and the defenders are charging. This might be his only chance. The crowd holds its breath as Morton swings his leg back and strikes the ball as hard as he can. It flies off the turf, arrowing past muddy defenders and straight into the corner of the goal. The crowd roars as Morton pumps his fist into the air. In the first ever FA Cup final, the Wanderers have taken the lead. As Morton Betts walks away from the goal, he receives a congratulatory slap on the back from his captain, Charles W. Alcock. But Charles isn't just captain. He's also secretary of the Football Association and the architect of the entire tournament. And whether they win or lose today, Charles and his players will have made history by playing in the very first FA Cup final on March 16, 1872. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is March 16, 1872, the first FA Cup final. It's February 26, 1867, at the Freemasons Tavern in London, 5 years before the first FA Cup final. 24-year-old Charles W. Alcock leans across a heavy oak table. The pub is loud, and it's hard to make out exactly what the men next to him are saying. They're all senior members of the Football Association. But if what Charles is hearing is right, that may not be the case for much longer. At the head of the table, the president of the association laments their ongoing failure to codify the laws of football into one coherent rulebook. For centuries, the game was little more than an excuse for a mass brawl, with hundreds of players scrapping over an inflated pig's bladder. But in recent decades, more rules were introduced to the game. Still, every town and school has its own unique laws, which meant that almost every time two teams met, there had to be some negotiation about what rules to use. No one had tried to establish a nationwide code until the Football Association was founded in 1863 to hammer out the definitive universal rulebook. But consensus has proved impossible to find. Debates have raged over the same three issues: handling the ball, scoring, and the method of tackling. A rift formed between two factions, and when compromise between them proved impossible, those who favored the rugby school rules walked away to form their own union, leaving the fractured FA in their wake. Now, the president of the association is proposing the unthinkable, dissolving the organization entirely. But Charles refuses to concede. He loves football. He runs his own club known as the Wanderers because they lack a permanent home and instead play their matches wherever they can. He's dedicated to the sport and not prepared to let the FA die. So he clinks his glass and the table falls silent, all eyes turning to him. Once he has their attention, Charles proposes a shift in strategy. Instead of trying to make everyone everywhere play the same way, they should focus their efforts on England's elite private schools. Charles himself attended Harrow, one of the most expensive institutions in the country. That's where he learned to play and love football himself. He believes that if the FA can convince Harrow and other similar schools to adopt a common rulebook, that code will filter down into other communities, gradually creating the universal game they all want. The others around the table agree to give the idea a shot, and Charles soon writes to Harrow, Eton College, Charterhouse, and Westminster. He makes sure the version of the game he suggests is familiar to the schools. That way, players at different institutions will only need to make minor adjustments before they can start arranging games with each other. This new set of rules becomes known as association football, and quickly, the word association gets shortened and corrupted into soccer, and momentum for the sport builds rapidly. With more and more teams adopting the FA rulebook, the organization's executive committee expands, and in February 1870, Charles is appointed its secretary and treasurer. It's the ideal choice to push the game forward. He's well known in sporting circles, not just as a soccer player, but as an enthusiastic cricketer as well. And that connection helps Charles secure a venue for the first ever international soccer match. The Kennington Oval in South London is home of the Surrey Cricket Club. But Charles manages to convince them to host an England versus Scotland soccer match. He's convinced that the clash between the old neighbors and rivals will capture the public imagination, but there's a problem. The FA rulebook hasn't spread much out of England. There aren't many Scottish footballers around. So Charles recruits players from London and includes anyone who boasts even vague ties to Scotland. And despite this charade, the game in March 1870 is a huge success. Closely fought tie sparks a call for a rematch, and that November, the two teams meet again. This time, the Scottish team manages to field three real Scotland-born players, but the roster remains a point of ridicule. One player is deemed eligible because his cousin married a Scot. This second match ends with a narrow win for the English team, but the real victory is Charles's, though. His stunt has become a huge success, but he's not satisfied yet. To keep soccer growing, he needs to think bigger. So on July 20th, 1871, he will propose a new nationwide tournament open to every club in the land. The Football Association will eagerly approve the plan, and the FA Cup will be born. It's the afternoon of November 11th, 1871, in Barn Elms Park, London. 4 months after Charles W. Alcock proposed a new tournament for the Football Association. 29-year-old Percy Weston glares angrily at his players. They huddle around him in a shivering circle, stamping the hard turf, their frozen hands tucked into their armpits. It's halftime in Barnes Football Club's first FA Cup appearance, and as captain, Percy is laying into his team. Their opponents are a team made of government clerks and are missing three players. Yet despite this advantage, Percy's men have failed to take the lead. So when play begins in the second half, Percy decides to take matters into his own hands. He controls the muddy, bobbling ball and drives straight at the civil service defenders. He sidesteps one only to collide with another, and with no teammates in sight, he just manages to shield the ball before wriggling free, swinging his cleat and hoping for the best. With the help of a gust of wind, the ball swerves through the air, clips a defender's hand, ricochets off another player's knee, and trickles through the wooden posts for a goal. The match ends with a Barnes victory, the first in the Football Association's new tournament. But elsewhere, the competition has become a logistical nightmare. Only four of the seven first-round matches even take place, with teams based outside London, like Glasgow's Queen's Park, unable to afford the cost of travel. So the FA is forced to give the Scottish team an automatic place in the semi-final. But it's still not enough to keep the tournament going. As competition progresses, more teams are given byes, so that by February 1872, only four teams remain. Glasgow Queen's Park will play Wanderers, and Crystal Palace will face the Royal Engineers for a place in the first ever FA Cup final. Having finally raised enough money to travel down from Scotland, Queen's Park arrives to face Charles Alcock's Wanderers on March 5, 1872, but the game ends without a goal. Charles proposes 30 minutes of extra time, but the Queen's Park's players refuse. They want a rematch later and depart London for their long journey back to Glasgow. The lack of goals continues in the other semi-final, where the Royal Engineers and Crystal Palace grind out another scoreless tie. The dramatic sporting spectacle Charles imagined is turning out to become a dud. But luckily, the rematch between the Royal Engineers and Crystal Palace is more exciting. The Royal Engineers score 3 goals without reply to book their place in the final. The other semi-final rematch is scheduled for the same day, but it never goes ahead. The players from Glasgow Queen's Park have decided they can't afford another trip to London and withdraw from the competition. That means the Wanderers automatically progress to the final. And despite all the chaos and disappointment of the earlier rounds, Charles Alcock now has the chance to create history and become the first captain to lift the FA Cup. So on March 16, 1872, he leads his Wanderers out onto the Kennington Oval cricket ground. On paper, the Royal Engineers look to be a far better team. They've put together a string of convincing victories to reach the final. But Charles has an ace up his sleeve. Walpole Vidal is one of the best players in the country, the man they call the Prince of Dribblers. And if the Wanderers can just pass in the ball, they might stand a chance. But once play begins, even getting a hold of the ball proves difficult. Right from the start, the Engineers dominate with intricate passing that carves the Wanderers wide open. Charles' men are just clinging on, and it seems only a matter of time before they concede. But then Charles and his players get a stroke of good luck. A crunching tackle leaves an Engineer with a fractured collarbone. With no substitutes allowed, the injured player retreats off the field, leaving the Engineers a man down. The Wanderers are quick to exploit this unexpected advantage. Winning back the ball more easily now, they feed it to Walpole Vidal. He dances his way through the Engineers' ranks. The last-ditch tackle halts his run, but the ball spills perfectly to Morton Betts, who lines up his shot and hammers it home. During the rest of the match, the Wanderers push for a second goal, but the opposing goalkeeper is equal to every strike. With the clock ticking down, the Engineers mount a late rally, but it's too late. The officials wave their handkerchiefs to signal the end of the match, and Charles's team has done it, winning the first-ever FA Cup 1-0. A few weeks later, inside a lavish restaurant in central London, their victory is toasted in style. As the winning captain, Charles Alcock is presented with a cup. It's just a small silver trophy, but it marks the beginning of something far greater. In the years to come, the FA Cup will get bigger and bigger, and soccer itself will grow and spread too, expanding far beyond the playing fields of England's elite schools to become the most popular sport in the world. It's April 28, 1923, at the Empire Stadium in Wembley, London, 51 years after the first FA Cup final. 25-year-old David Jack intercepts the ball and quickly swivels. He doesn't look for a pass. The roaring walls of fans surrounding the field means he can barely even think straight. All he can see is his opponent's goal, and he quickly lines up a shot. Today is the first FA Cup final to be held at the new home of English soccer, Wembley. But the match almost didn't go ahead. This stadium was only finished a few days ago, and the organizers underestimated how many people would show up. In the end, more than 200,000 tried to get into the stadium, and for a time they spilled onto the field, making it impossible for the game to start. Police on horseback eventually managed to clear them, but the final was delayed by 45 minutes. But now, in the spring sunshine, David Jack is making up for lost time. He unleashes a shot so fierce that for a moment the vast crowd is silent, just watching. Then the ball thunders into the goal and the spectators erupt. The roar echoes around the stadium like nothing David has ever heard before. It makes him feel like a giant. And with confidence flooding through him, his team coasts to a victory. 51 years after Charles Alcock's Wanderers won the first FA Cup, it's the turn of David and his team Bolton Wanderers to lift the trophy. Charles himself is long dead, but his legacy is plain to see today. As FA secretary, he standardized the rules of soccer and paved the way for a truly national game. And although just 15 teams competed in the first FA Cup in 1872, now more than 500 from across England enter the tournament every year. The game was once shaped by the elite, but has been seized by the working class and teams from industrial cities like Sheffield, Birmingham and Bolton, who dominate the game in the 1920s. The FA Cup will remain woven into the fabric of English sporting life throughout the 20th century and beyond, It will inspire competitions in other nations and between them as well, creating a blueprint for tournaments from the FIFA World Cup to the Olympics. It will also be the stage for some of the most dramatic and memorable moments in the history of soccer. But it all began with a small crowd of spectators at a cricket ground in South London on March 16, 1872. Next on History Daily, March 17, 1861. After more than a decade of revolutionary violence, the unified Kingdom of Italy is born. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Throng. This episode is written and researched by Angus Gavin McCarr. Edited by William Simpson. Managing producer, Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.